Hey there, lovely Real Crime Profile listeners. Well, welcome to episode 238, part three in our Profiling Bill Cosby series. Now, you would be aware that it was International Women's Day on March the 8th, which was Sunday. And here at Real Crime Profile, we're paying tribute to the incredible Shiro survivors who say Bill Cosby drugged and or sexually assaulted them or attempted to do so. And we're paying tribute by naming each of the women, the incredible Shiro survivors who've shown tremendous courage and mental fortitude. And we want to show that they've not been forgotten, because these are the women that were the first wave of Me Too. And we want you to know that we see you, we hear you, and we believe you. So I'm going to read each name. Andrea Constand, Christina Ruhli, Sunny Wells, Carla Farino, Linda Brown, Sindra Ladd, Joan Tarshies, Victoria Valentino, Linda Traits, Tamara Green, Autumn Burns, Kathy McKee, Colleen Hughes, Louisa Moritz, Lisa, Donna Motzinger, Sean Upshaw, Helen Hayes, Linda Ridgway Whitedeer, Judy Huff, Donna Tagliaferri, Marcella Tate, Margie Shapiro, Therese Serenese, Elizabeth, Sharon Van Ett, Sarita Butterfield, Joyce Emmons, PJ Maston, Patricia Stewart, Pamela Ebeta, Linda Kirkpatrick, Janice Baker Kinney, Janice Dickinson, Beth Ferrier, Renita Cheney Hill, Denise Ferrari, Heidi Thomas, Dottie, Barbara Bowman, Beverly Johnson, Pat O'Connor, Lisa Jones, Becky Cooper, Shalane Lasher, Sammy Mays, Helen Gumpel, Jennifer Kaya Thompson, Jewel Allison, Eden Tyrie, Lisa Christie, Lisa Lott Lublin, Lily Bernard, Angela Leslie, Michelle Hurd, Kelly Johnson, Michelle Covington, Donna Barrett, Chloe Goines, Virginia Bennett, Jane Doe Number 3, Charlotte Fox, Elizabeth, and Stacey Pinkerton. Now, there are no doubt many more, because Cosby was so prolific. But we see you, we hear you, and we believe you. And so without further ado, let's go to our episode with the amazing investigative reporter, Nikki Wysensee Egan.
The last thing I remember was Bill Cosby in a patchwork robe, dropping his robe and getting on top of me. He had given me wine and a pill. The next morning I woke up and I wasn't wearing my pajamas. And I remember before I passed out that I had been sexually assaulted by this man.
Mr. Cosby walked me to the bedroom after a second shot of amaretto. He said it would help my cold. I lay down. He laid next to me on the bed and began pinching my left nipple, humping on my leg while he was grunting. I could not open my eyes. I couldn't move or say anything. I felt something warm on my legs, and I blacked out. 13 to 16 hours later, I woke up to him clapping his hands, saying, "Daddy says, wake up." He gave me $1,500, and he said the money was to buy something nice for me and my grandmother, and also invited us to go to the Temptations with my grandmother. My grandmother went, but I did not go because I felt too sick. Then he invited us to his show. My grandmother really wanted to go, but I didn't. But I went, and I heckled him. As a result, I was fired. My life destroyed.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clementi, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor and writer-producer of CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today is...
Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, former New Scotland Yard and founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And Lisa Zambetti, casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds. And with us today is...
Nikki Wisenseegan. I'm a host of Chasing Cosby, the podcast, author of a book of the same name, and an award-winning investigative journalist.
Well, thank you so much for coming back to us and talking about your podcast and your book and this maddening case against Bill Cosby, who's now a convicted sex offender.
In between the mistrial from the first trial and the second trial in April 2018, the Me Too movement exploded. So they were trying to raise it back then as well. And it kills me because he'll say, this is racist, it's a racist system. And I'm thinking, you had seven private attorneys at your second trial who making, I don't know, they had to have That legal bill alone had to be at least $1 million. I don't know many.
Far more than that. More than that.
Oh, at least. I mean, he has had other lawyers suing him I've never even heard of that he owes a few hundred thousand to. So I can't even imagine how much he owes these. And it's just, you know, this is not about race. This is about power, wealth, and privilege and how it insulated him for so many years. How many African-American defendants, or any defendant for that matter, can afford to post $1 million cash bail, 10% of it, or hire seven of the top criminal defense attorneys in the country to represent them at a trial. You know,
The women are all mixed as well. We're not talking about all black women or all white women. They're mixed. And I have always had the view, if you're raping women or if you're doing bad things, your race doesn't come into it. And I think, why should you be able to act within impunity if you're black or if you're brown or if you're white? You shouldn't. Privilege has to come out of it. I agree. And I'm watching very closely to see what happens with Weinstein. And I'm looking very closely to see whether Donna Ricciuto becomes Bill Cosby's next lawyer, the antithesis of the Me Too movement. And that's what she's carving her name out to be. But the whole, I've had an unfair trial, I don't believe that for a minute, looking at the evidence. And you've, of course, been in it for 15 years, researching it and understanding it in granular detail.
Right. And that is how he tends to hire his attorney. See, Monique Presley, he saw on TV defending him. She became his attorney. Tom Mesereau, who was Michael Jackson's attorney and won an acquittal there, he saw on TV defending him and hired him. So you're right. It could be his next because he's on his 25th, 26th, 27th attorneys, like numbers. He get every time he loses, he gets rid of them. And he
Control.
Did lose the one. Yeah.
Control.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. So.
Yeah, well, one of the things that pisses me off about a lot of defense attorneys is that they will blatantly lie. They know the truth. They will absolutely make up something, create an argument to try to create reasonable doubt, to try to throw the scent off of their client. And I don't believe that's how the justice system is supposed to work. I don't believe that's actually legitimate. I believe they took an oath when they joined the bar, and that they are only supposed to speak the truth. And if they don't have something to defend their client, then they should be mute. They should not be creating false narratives, and they do it all the time. It's outrageous, and it's why victims have such a hard time coming forward.
I know. At the first trial, I was sitting there going, the way Andrea was being bashed and the way I was just sitting there going, I was in D.C. when they need a hill. Hearings happened and I felt like I was in a time warp and it was like 1991 again because the same type of things that Anita Hill had been criticized for, they were thrown at Andrea. But I think what the prosecution did better for the second trial is they put the sexual assault expert up first. Dr. Barbara Ziv, who's testifying in the Weinstein, they'd hired her right after that. And by the way, Weinstein was charged after Cosby was convicted, which I don't think was a coincidence.
Right.
But they had her testify first and explain, you know, debunk rape myths and explain victim behavior and really educate the jury about what they were about to hear, that, hey, this might seem a little strange to you, but this is the norm for sexual assault cases. And I think that really made a difference. And you'll hear from the jury foreperson and one of the jurors from the second trial in episode 6. They're in my book as well, because they were very reluctant to talk. I had to really convince them, but they were everything you hope a jury will be, because I never thought about it before, but nobody tells the jury how to deliberate, right? They just say, go in a room and figure out if this person's guilty or not. Basically, they give them the guidelines, but still no one says, do you vote first? Do you do this? And And the first jury really struggled. It took them 52 hours. And I think because I think they must have voted more than once because different ones were given a different accounts of how, what the votes were. But this jury was very methodical. And the foreperson is like vice president of cybersecurity for an international emergency management firm. So she's very methodical and very precise. And, you know, I think that made a difference. But I do think the sexual assault expert testifying first was really what helped.
Yes, and that's quite unusual to testify first. But and she gave excellent testimony in the Weinstein trial, because the rape myths are important for people to understand because they are still very prevalent. And the whole point of coercive control and entrapment and victims, they don't behave as what people think that they would. Most do stay in contact with an abuser who has more power than them. That's the norm. It's not an anomaly, as Donna Ricciuno would try and mislead the court to think that each of the victims, it was abnormal what they did. It was absolutely normal. And I think it's so important that we educate people so that they understand, because we know here in the US, 1% of offenders get convicted of sexual, of rape and sexual assault, and it's 1.45% in the UK. So the conviction rates are incredibly low. And I think that context is really important for our listeners to understand, because it's not easy to get a conviction because of the rape myths and because of the way these cases, sometimes, you know, prosecution not really understanding coercive control and other dynamics, sometimes they don't call experts to come and give evidence. But I think it's very important that they hear from experts first before they hear from victims, so that they can really understand the dynamics of what happens in the psychology and the trauma that lasts for a very long time. It doesn't just dissipate. And so there's no normal, everyone does one thing or another, but it's highly likely when there is a relationship and a position of power that one has over the other and a breach of trust that they stay in contact. There's a way of managing the relationship.
I was going to say, when I testified as an expert witness, I had to convince the prosecutors to let me go first. I wanted the jury to hear it with educated ears and see the evidence with educated eyes, because otherwise they've made their decisions as they're listening to the witnesses testify and seeing the evidence. This trial could be a week or a month or many months long. And to then at the end try to put that in a different light is just, it's just not worth it. And I think that basically when you have an education witness, it's because the jury doesn't necessarily understand the behavior that they're about to see. And so, of course, we don't take the test first and then learn the lesson. We learn the lesson first. And I mean, Tom Mesereau is very famously said that I was only going to testify in the Michael Jackson case as an education witness. Well, of course, that's what they needed in the trial. Unfortunately, I got cancer and was getting treatment at the time that the trial started, so I didn't testify. But I think that would have made a major difference in that trial, because all people were looking at was the icon and then this kid and his troubled family. And they didn't have anybody to put it in context. It really is critically important. And I would encourage, although I don't testify anymore because of my health issues, I would encourage prosecutors across the country to always put in sexual assault cases an education expert witness, because that's your opportunity to really educate the jury so that they know what they're seeing.
In Pennsylvania, you couldn't do that until 2013. It was only after the Jerry Sandusky case that they finally passed this law, mm-hmm. allowing a sexual assault expert to testify. And then they can't talk about the specifics of the case. They have to testify in general. And the first trial, they had a woman testifying later on, and it was not a great testimony, and she did keep getting specific. And it turns out Pennsylvania was the 50th state in the nation to allow sexual assault experts to testify in these cases. I knew our state was backward, but I didn't realize it was that bad.
It is a common law state. It's the only, I think it's either one of two or the only common law state left in the United States. And yes, it does have some archaic laws that I'm glad to hear are changing. But when you testify as an expert witness and as an education expert, whenever I did that, when the prosecutor called me, I said, no, don't tell me the facts of the case. I'm going to tell you what I will say, and you will see whether or not it fits the facts of your case, and the jury will as well. I don't need to know anything about your guy. And that, to me, that undermines any attempt at cross-examination that I'm tailoring my testimony. And I also brought my presentations that I've given for dozens of years around the world and showed this is exactly the information that I tell people all the time. It doesn't have anything to do with your case. And they're always shocked at how exactly it describes their defendant.
Who would want 15 minutes of this kind of, not fame, shame? So I'm here, not that I think I'm this great courageous character person, but to say to the others who have come forward and who I hope will come forward, it takes courage.
But I think the language, and of course with Cosby, the language was distorted as well. The whole time, the accuser, sexual misconduct, inappropriate conduct with women rather than rape. And I know Weinstein fought very hard when the New York Times were going to publish. He objected to the words rape being used. And of course, this dilutes everything. But language really does matter when we're describing what's happened to someone and calling it what it is. Jim and I feel very strongly about that and making it clear to people what it is. And the more experts that can be used to raise awareness, the better, as far as I'm concerned, whether it's domestic abuse, whether it's stalking. You know, these dynamics of psychologically rooted crimes that where trauma really does manifest. We have to think about rape. It's not about physical force. And too often we hear about physical force. Well, what did you do? Did you fight back? Did you scream? You know, where you can have a freeze response. Well, in this case, he incapacitated them. So they didn't stand a chance to fight back. And that was something that was part of his MO and probably his signature, that he knew that he would have a guarantee, a body that would lie there and not be able to fight back. So asking, well, she, and allowing him to say, well, she didn't at any point say she didn't like it. Well, she was incapacitated. How could she possibly?
Yeah,
it's unbelievable.
I know of 64 known victims of Cosby, and of them, only Andrea's was within the statute of limitations, which I was surprised. Like when her case came back up in 2015, I did not see that coming. I thought it was over with and done with, but right. The charges were aggravated indecent assault, and it was a 12-year statute of limitations. But with all of the other victims, it was long gone. And I write about in the book, I'm like, this is why it's a shame that Castor backed off the way he did in 2005 and that the media did, because the media could have really kept the pressure on back in 2005. And then maybe, you know, it would have forced Castor to really investigate this case. More women would have probably kept coming forward. And then maybe some of these other cases wouldn't be outside the statute of limitations. Lily Bernard was in 91. By the time she went to police in 2015, she had just missed it. The statute of limitations in New Jersey for what happened to her, because they changed the law in 96, but it wasn't grandfathered. So they removed the statute of limitations altogether in New Jersey in 96, but they didn't grandfather it. But she might have had a chance in 2005, right. You know, and that's the shame. There's so many women out there who will never see any kind of justice.
There were a number of statute of limitations that were 4 or 5 years. I mean, sexual assault in New York was 5 years for a while, for a long, long, long time, and 7 years and depending on the severity of the crime. And so it had no relationship to the actual facts of those kinds of cases, the actual delay in reporting and the difficulty in coming forward and dealing with it. And if you add drugs to the mix, and some of these are amnesiacs, so memories are either erased or at least clouded, and he did that purposefully. I mean, he used a drug that would cause those reactions. It's such a hideous type of behavior.
There's one woman who was in the second episode, who was a masseuse. He knew she known him from the club where she worked for about a month before it happened. And after he assaulted her, the last thing she remembers is walking out of there with her massage table. She woke up 2 days later in her own bedroom, had no idea how she'd gotten there. Her roommates found her passed out in her car. She drove. And they put her in bed and they kept checking on her to make sure she was breathing. She woke up 2 days later. She's like, how did I drive home? And Tamara Green too. She doesn't know how she was able to drive. She like nicked a car, and that's why she finally went to this all night club and slept it off there. So, you know, there's that aspect of it as well. And she, like I said, she did not, Becky Cooper did not remember how she got home. Her roommates found her passed out in her car. She'd driven, no idea how she did it.
So harrowing. I mean, it's just the wreckage that he left behind for so many people, women trying to piece together, you know, two nights of their life or 2 days and trying to figure out what happened to them. He just took so much from so many people or so many women. It's just really staggering and just harrowing listening to their accounts. It's so raw on the podcast. You know, it really is. And I think you've done such a fantastic job, Nikki, of you know, chasing this story down and giving women a platform to talk, because I certainly haven't heard all their voices together. And it's a very hard listen, but it's so important that it's all pieced together, the jigsaw, to really reveal who he was behind that facade, that curtain, that he conned all of us, them, but he conned all of us too.
He did.
Yeah. And can you tell us a little bit about the DA, the new DA, Kevin Steele?
Kevin is, you know, I just actually posted something about him the other day. He won another Victims Assistance Award because he's the guy you hope gets your case. He's a prosecutor. He got accused by Cosby's people of being like the politically prosecutor who just had political aspirations or whatever. And I'm like, no, that was Bruce Castor, because Bruce had just run for governor right before this happened. Kevin has the job he wants and that's it. And he truly is one of the good guys. He's just one of the guys that looks out for the victims. And, you know, for that, he has been called racist. He's been called everything you can think of, but he is just genuinely a good person and a nice guy. And I used to joke with his people. I said, I think his motto should be too nice to be a prosecutor, because he's very aggressive, but he doesn't have that cutthroat, vicious side to them that some of the best prosecutors have, that ruthlessness, right? Mm-hmm. He's just a nice guy, but he's very good at his job. And it was his idea to put the sexual assault expert first in the second trial, because they went back, you know, they talked to the jurors after the first trial. They tried to get a sense of what was right, what right, what went wrong. When you get a mistrial, something didn't go right. Mm-hmm. And that was his idea. And it was brilliant. I really think it made a difference.
Yeah. When I joined the behavioral analysis unit, the people in my unit who are experts in various fields about behavior, and they generally would testify about specifics about the cases. And with my previous experience as a prosecutor, I was trying to sort of reshape that into something that would actually be usable in almost every sex crime case or murder case. And we, you know, worked together and we came up with the sort of education witness model so that defense attorneys couldn't exclude our testimony and that prosecutors could use it to actually bring the jury up to a level where they can understand this type of evidence. They allowed it in drug cases where a DEA agent could get up there and say, well, this is how a drug transaction is made and this is the codes they use and this is the what you'll see behaviorally, but they had never done it in sex crimes before. So it's really good that is now permeating the country. And I'm so happy that the DA, Kevin Steele, cared about justice and fought for it. And because it's really changed the landscape, because this case in our lifetime, can you think of another icon that is anywhere close to Bill Cosby, who we all know was committing crimes, but actually got convicted of the sexual assault that or in other cases, murder that they committed. It's very, very difficult to do that when you have an iconic celebrity.
It is. And I don't think it was a coincidence that the month after the guilty verdict, all of a sudden, you know, Harvey Weinstein's charged. The prosecutors had that case for quite a while, didn't really know what to do with it. And Bill Cosby's convicted. And the next month, Harvey Weinstein's charged. And then they immediately say they want Dr. Barbara Ziv as their expert. Right. So, yeah, I think it was an extraordinarily courageous thing for him to do. And they just felt compelled once the deposition parts of it got unsealed. There were the Quaaludes admissions and what really hasn't come out much is that the DA at the time in 2015 was a woman, Risa Furman, who was Bruce Castor's first assistant in 2005. So she knew all about this case back then, and she's the one who told Castor at the time that these tapes are admissible. Wow. And she's now a judge. She was running for judge then, so she's never really spoken. I saw some of her deposition in the defamation cases. So she's the one who reopened it. And I don't want to get on a... I do think the female detective, female DA sometimes makes a difference. Kevin was her first assistant. But they had to go to Dolores, Andrea's attorney, and say, if we reopen this, will Andrea cooperate? Because it was a real concern, because Andrea had been treated so terribly by Castor in 2005 that, you know, they didn't know if she would cooperate. But it was a different DA, and she agreed, and they went up to meet with her. But then Castor starts running for his old job back in 2015. He wants to be DA again, which I have always thought that was not a coincidence, because whatever went down with him and Cosby, Cosby had enough power to control people to say, you make sure this doesn't happen. But the Cosby thing became an ad in the campaign, but Steele won.
Thank goodness. Thank goodness. But there was a young black female prosecutor. Yes. I can't remember her name, but
Kristen Fenn, and she's in the podcast too. She was amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, she went to meet Andrea, didn't she? And from what I understand, got the Andrea on board because she's prosecuted so many cases before. And wasn't there something in the NDA that she couldn't talk to police as well? And therefore someone had to actively go and speak to her rather than the other way around.
Yes. What came out was very interesting. There were Castor testified for 7 hours in February of 2016 about this immunity, this press release that was an immunity agreement. And so Dolores and Phoebe had to testify as well, Andrea's attorneys. And they talked about how at first Cosby wanted in there that she couldn't cooperate with authorities if there was an investigation ever again. And they refused to do that. They said that's obstruction of justice. No, we're not going to make that part of her agreement. So that what the agreement was that she couldn't go to law enforcement, but if they came to her, she was allowed to speak with them. Well, after Cosby got charged in 2015, he filed a breach of contract lawsuit against Andrea and her attorneys, saying they broke the NDA and this agreement by cooperating with law enforcement. And they filed that the night before Castor was going to testify at this hearing that was trying to get the charges dismissed, because Castor was saying, you know, you can't charge him. I made an agreement with him in 2005 that he would never be charged. And it was
a prosecutor doesn't have a right to ever do that, ever, unless the person pled guilty to the crime and then was given a cooperation agreement. There's no mechanism by which a prosecutor can say, you will never be charged for this crime. It's just, especially within the statute of limitations. How is he saying that?
He said it was an immunity agreement. And I remember watching Judge O'Neill, and he's looking, because he's known Castor for years, and Castor actually started leaking negative information about the judge to some of the media, which was pretty awful. But he looked at him and said, Bruce, you know how this works. An immunity agreement, you have to have it signed off on by a judge. And then maybe you give it a miscellaneous case number and throw it in a drawer somewhere, but you don't just issue a press release, basically, and call it an immunity agreement. You know this, Bruce. And Bruce was just like, nope. But what? And he started calling himself the sovereign. It was the most amazing thing I've ever seen in my life.
But you give immunity agreements to defendants who come in and say, I am going to tell you the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And anything that you tell me can be used against you if you lie once or if you don't tell me the whole truth. That's what an immunity agreement is usually based on in today's justice system, or even 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago. I've never seen, and this is the kind of thing that the AUSA in Florida tried to do with Epstein. He tried to even extend that even further to other co-defendants or potential co-defendants. But again, it doesn't work that way unless A, he's been fully cooperative, and B, like you said, a judge signs off on it. The judge is the official arbiter of whether or not this person gets charged, not the prosecutor. And if the prosecutor declines prosecution, which is within their discretion, then that prosecutor has to deal with the fact that he's either hired or he's voted in, elected, and he could lose that job because of those things. But in this case, a press release? Come on.
Right. It's still part of Cosby's appeal. I mean, it just got rejected by the state court. But that's part of it, that, you know, he never should have been prosecuted because of this press release that was an immunity agreement. And they're using it for the appeal they just filed as well. It's part of it.
It could go up to the Supreme Court. It literally could. But and that prosecutor making those claims, if a Supreme Court justice makes a determination that Cosby relied on it, then I think it could only go to statements that he made, though. It can't go to what other people said about him. I don't understand how you can immunize somebody against a victim's statements. I just don't understand how that's possible legally.
No, he said he did that, and that's why Cosby was so open during his deposition and said so much, because he knew that none of it could be used against him in a future criminal case. I mean, it's circular logic, and I don't know what they quite came up with it, but...
He spoke about other cases as well. He didn't just speak about Andrea's case, and so that logic falls apart. It's absolutely ridiculous. He did not know that he couldn't be prosecuted anywhere else. I mean, he didn't know what statute of limitations changes might happen in other states and how they could be grandfathered. There's just no way. And he's speaking in a civil case, and he certainly could have been brought up on civil charges as well. And, you know, like New York just recently did a one-year moratorium on the statute of limitations for child sex crimes. And because of that, people can bring cases from 50 years, 60 years, 70 years earlier. It's just not a good leg to stand on, but I'm sure he will stand on it, and it could go all the way to the Supreme Court.
At that time, I had absolutely no idea that there was anyone other than myself. This was at the height of his fame.
You thought you were alone.
I was alone, and I'm carrying the burden of this secret of America's favorite father.
In a larger sense, though, I do think he was so, because Dolores talks about this, that he wanted to tell these stories about these women. He was enjoying himself going into great detail about everything he did to them. And I think in a larger sense, he probably thought, I got away with this again. No one can touch me. So I do think there was some of that belief in his head going on, because that's what had been happening to him for the past 40 years. He had been getting away with doing this, and he'd just gotten away with it again. He was able to make it go away. So in a larger sense, I do believe that maybe he had that belief when he was waxing poetic about all of these horrible things he did to all of these women. But it was also a very contentious deposition, which is why it took 4 days over a 6-month period. He would refuse to answer questions, and they would have to go to the judge. Mm-hmm. So a lot of that was going on as well. And
all about control. But thank goodness it was unsealed, because that deposition was really critical in this case, wasn't it?
Right. And, you know, what happened is, after the case exploded again, AP was interesting, because they very much in 2005, all their stories were tilted toward Cosby. I mean, they would write a story and it'd be like, Bill Cosby defends himself against blah, instead of just reporting it. And then they did that infamous interview with him in 2015 with him and Camille, of course, Camille doesn't rarely talks in these interviews, where he's pressuring the AP, because they ask him about the sexual assault, and he's pressuring them, but I know the AP wouldn't use those quotes. I know I can call up so-and-so and so-and-so. And they didn't release it for like 2 weeks, but they finally did, because the cases just kept snowballing. So then they decided to go back to court and see if they could get some of these motions unsealed from 2005 that had excerpts of the deposition. And the judge, they fought that out for 7 months, and then the judge ultimately ruled to unseal them, because he said Cosby had narrowed his right to privacy by all of his public moralizing over the years. And so therefore he lost his right to have these sealed. But the deposition itself wasn't completely unsealed. The clerk made a mistake. They thought it was, and sold it to the New York Times and some other media, but then discovered, no, he didn't unseal the whole deposition. But by that time it was too late. Like, I have a copy. It became an exhibit in Tamar Green's defamation lawsuit against Cosby. And, you know, it's out there. So it was kind of a fascinating chain of events.
Fortunate. chain of events.
Fortunate chain of events, really. I mean, because there were still a lot of people calling these women liars. And I still say part of it was because Gloria Allred had held this press conference early on in like December 2014, where she had a couple of the women there and didn't tell them she was going to do this, but she called on Cosby to create this $100 million victim fund for the women. And I just think like Marty Singer was out there releasing all these statements saying all these women are just out for money. They're lying because they want money. Mm. And then she just kind of handed him that, you know, proof on a silver platter. It was just, and after that, I really think, you know, it was hard for these women that were coming forward because everybody just assumed, you know, they wanted this $100 million victim fund, which never actually was anything. But the women at the second trial were cross-examined about that by Cosby's attorneys. Well, didn't we do this for this $100 million victim fund? And it just, they became tarred with that brush for a very long time.
It's unfortunate, but she probably thought that nothing was actually going to happen in a court of law, and that might be the only way to address the issues. But yeah, unfortunately, it splashed back on the victims.
Right. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's just bad timing. I mean, maybe don't do that right away.
Yeah. Well, timing's everything, and Gloria Allred and Lisa Bloom keep popping up in these cases.
Yeah.
I have to say, there was a press conference with Gloria Allred just before Weinstein's trial began. We can't do that in the UK. And I really think that that should be the same in the US, that it puts people more at risk in exactly this way. So you have to think about down the line, what might be the blowback when there's a lawyer there wanting money and their gain is money. But for the victims, it can be a very negative thing. So I did listen to what Gloria said on your podcast. And of course, she has represented, was it 12 victims or 17 victims in the Cosby case, or even more, maybe?
She, of the six, I think she represented a third of the, no, more than half of the three. But she just represents them for media appearances. There's only one that actually resulted in a case, the Judy Hooks case, which is still pending. It just got delayed again while Cosby appeals. But she just represents them for media appearances, usually. It's not right. like a lawsuit or anything like that. But yeah, she represented like half of them. And she gives them a voice, and I give her that. Like, she gives the victims a voice, and she gives them a platform, and I give her that. I just think in this case, it was the timing was just bad. And the women didn't know she was going to do it before the press conference.
Well, that again is a major problem. I mean, being a victim advocate, I'd never spring anything on a victim that we're suddenly going to invite the media in. I mean, it's the worst thing you can do. But right. I think you probably know about Lisa Bloom, who was on Harvey Weinstein's payroll, who had a very clear strategy to take down victims. So it just seems the same two names just keep bouncing around in all these cases, you know, whether it's Epstein and there's all these crossovers. But the key thing is that we keep the spotlight on the perpetrators and we keep talking about them and shedding light on what right. they're doing and empowering victims to come forward and to tell their stories and supporting them when they do and still asking them questions, because that should happen. But in terms of the perpetrator, we can't lose sight of it's somebody who's done this to 60 women, 70 women, probably hundreds and hundreds of women. So I think it's a very important one, particularly as Cosby, Weinstein, they all think they're going to have a comeback. They're not finished. And what does it take? What is a woman's life worth? I always say this, but really, what is a woman's life worth when we don't listen to them and we don't believe them and we think they're making things up and we let a serial perpetrator just keep doing it over and over again? And I hate to think post-Castor how many other women were abused by Cosby because of what he did, because of the decisions that he took. Who knows? Maybe you know, Nikki, but serial perpetrators don't stop, particularly if they are deriving a sadistic sense of power and control, and they're enjoying that, and they're being blatant and brazen. And Bill Cosby had a lot of bravado about it. He's very, very twisted and sadistic.
The Judy Hooks, this case of Gloria's, was from 2008. And I've gotten tips on other ones, but none I could pin down. But I agree with what you're saying. I keep doing it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But is there anything that you just want to say about what we've covered so far that is a burning, I must say this or let them know that?
Well, just, you know, how hard this still was, even with the second trial, because I was sitting in the courtroom and I talk about this, like one of the main reasons I stayed on this is because I saw how the media jumped on the Cosby bandwagon in 2014, and I knew they could just as easily jump off again. And I started kind of watching that happen in the second trial. The defense put up a witness called Marguerite Jackson. She worked for Temple, And she claimed that Andrea had told her, like, the year before that she was going to set up someone high profile for money, that they'd shared a room on a Temple women's basketball trip, and that's when she told him that. And some of the reporters in the room were looking at me like, oh, wow, Nikki, did you see that? And I said, okay, let's take that to its natural conclusion. If Andrea was after money, she got her money in 2006 when she settled the lawsuit. Why is she here? You know, why did she put herself through not one criminal trial, but two? If she's out for money, she already got it. But they were really buying into that, and they were really thinking that. And you know, why? Because it's so much fun to be called a con artist and headlines all over the world. I mean, I don't even want to draw attention to it, but there is this awful video out there that this one site put up, which tries to make claims that her family's racist. And I mean, it is horrible. It is like they could easily sue that place for defamation and win, but that's not the type of people they are. They only ended up doing it when they pushed with their back to the wall. So I just hope that a lot of the damage that's been done to her and her family's reputation can start to get repaired. So many people base their opinions on this case based on emotion. I just want people to seek out facts. You could read my book. I'm not suggesting that, but all the trial transcripts, every document is online for free. Go read them. Don't just base your opinion on the bits and pieces you hear in the media or even this podcast or my podcast or even my book. Search out facts and then speak up, because I think too many people, their opinions based on emotion.
I think that's an important point. And I'll say to our listeners, definitely read your book and read your book and be able to differentiate the TV character and the man. The facts and the evidence, the TV character and the man, because they're two different people. A TV character is fictional. And I think that's what, just when I've looked at a lot of interviews and watched them, that's what a lot of people struggle with, particularly the Black community, because Cosby was this icon, but
absolutely,
his TV icon personality is so different than who he was. And I think that's an important point, seeking out the trial transcripts. And I do hope Andrea and the other women are starting to heal, because it takes a very long time. It really does. And I think you've done an incredible job of giving them a voice and bringing the facts and the evidence to the forefront and to cut through the noise. And that's what we have to do in these cases, cut through the noise and help people really understand the facts and the evidence.
Yeah, we really thank you, Nikki, for doing that. You're really a very, very important hero in this. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much. I always say it's the survivors. They took an enormous amount of courage to go public against someone like Bill Cosby, and they're amazing. But thank you.
They really are. Well, we still have so much more to say, and we have many more questions to ask you.
Great. You'll see episode 5 is about their statute of limitations work too. So you'll be able to really see how they used this platform, not to like make money, but to try to help other survivors. And then you'll hear from what Andrea is up to now too in episode 6, which I think is amazing. So.
That's awesome.
Well, I would love to hear that. And I'd love to hear more from Jim just about the statute of limitations in different states as well. And I think it's brilliant that women are coordinating the legal challenge as to why there's a statute of limitations, particularly when we know people come forward much later on in life. So I want to ask Jim questions, but we'll have to do that in our next pod that we record on this fascinating and confounding and complex case prolific and serial perpetrator. So thank you so much for your time, Nikki. And for now, this is Real Crime Profile signing out.
If you like deeper analysis like this episode on topics like Making a Murderer, Mindhunter, Escape at Dannemora,
the case of Sally Challen, the teacher's pet, Lynette Dawson, the Exonerated Five and When They See Us, and the disappearance of Madeleine McCann, you can listen to RCP on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or whatever platform you listen to us on. And please be sure, if you like what we do, to give us a 5-star review.
Thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile. Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107 or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214-946-4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.